develop that talent. Okay, if you did the reading this week, of course, you would have noticed that we have an enormous amount of duplication in the material that we'll be covering here tonight. So we've got a sort of a free night in a way, in that we have now gotten well into the overlapping material of Kings and Chronicles. There's a very significant amount of material that is not quite verbatim or word for word, but comes well nigh unto it. And here in the life of Solomon, in the historical record of Solomon's life, of course, this week, we have a second pass through information, stories that we've already studied. It would have been 2 weeks ago. And so what we're going to do tonight is a little bit of review, since in a way handling both Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon last week, we had to somewhat short that material. So we'll come back to some of that just by way of review and then some additional material here in a moment. But the book of Ecclesiastes, last week we looked at Ecclesiastes. We read 12 chapters in the book of Ecclesiastes. I did not actually point out the statistic that you see on the screen now, but that phrase, under the sun, occurs 29 times in 12 chapters. 29 times. And in fact, there are only three chapters in which it does not occur. Chapter 7 does not use the phrase, nor chapter 11 or 12. But with the exception of those three chapters, 29 times in a relatively small book is an awful lot to have an expression like that. What immediately does that expression tell you? The book is about a particular kind of life. What life? Life under the sun, which if you had to pick between the two kinds of lives, that would be physical life, material life, life in the flesh, life as we find it, you know, down here where you have to live in a body and you have to get up in the morning and you have to figure out a way to somehow find food, you know, and shelter. And so we've got all these issues that are going on in the physical life. Life under the sun is not focusing on your spiritual life. It's not focusing on an immaterial life, that is a non-physical life. And so it is a somewhat unique book from the standpoint that it is very consciously, very purposely, and very obviously wanting to say, let's kind of set the spiritual side apart for a moment. Let's set the doctrinal side, if you will. We're not going to deal with God's plan of salvation. These aren't the issues that we're working with. What we're going to be working with in Ecclesiastes is just how to get along, you know, every day between the time you rise and the time you go to sleep. Another statistic I just didn't point out last week, that word vanity, some translations have futility, occurs slightly more than the phrase under the sun. 32 times in 12 chapters, so an average of 3 times per chapter, and along with many other kind of similar expressions, either in single words or in, you know, a phrase, that many people attribute, you know, to being hopeless expressions or expressions of hopelessness. And so the big question, of course, arises. We dealt with it at length last week, that why such a book, why the information in the book, and was the book really intended to be just totally fatalistic? Was the book intended to be depressing? Was the book intended to be discouraging, which is the way many people, commentators, even in the chronological Bible, the editors, suggested that that was the case. Is that the case? No. Not the case at all. Now, to use a different term, last week I had a couple of illustrations of pointing out, you know, how I understand the book and all of that. But one of my dad's favorite expressions I can remember from really, really young is this one. That's the way the cookie crumbles. That's the way the cookie crumbles. I would have some whiny gripe or whatever, you know, as a child. I would experience some kind of failure or whatever, you know. And my dad would just so many times, he would say, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. And what does he mean? That's life. That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April. Shotgun in May. Okay? That's life. And so get used to it, kid, is what he was trying to tell me. My dad was real good that way. I really appreciated him for that, real practical kind of a man, you know, and he was a no-nonsense kind of a guy. So he wasn't taking anything from me, no lip, no disrespect, and no foolishness either, son. That's the way the cookie crumbles. That's the way the world works. You know, get used to it. And that's what life under the sun is all about. So we talked about that last week. What I'd like for you to do now is to open up to the book of Ecclesiastes from last week. That book begins on page 486. Everybody just come to page 486. And for a minute, let me just, you know, turn the class over to you. If you were taking my advice last week, you should now be able to find marked on the pages of your Bible all of the great things, the happy things, the upbeat things, the positive things that you find in the book. So even if you didn't mark them, somebody tell me, just what do you remember? What, you know, in the midst of all this supposed hopelessness and despair, was he actually trying to do? He was trying to help us be happy in this life. So what are some of the positive things that we found in the book? Anybody? Okay, Elaine's got the very first one. It's chapter 2 and verse 10. And in this second chapter, in that 10th verse, Solomon was saying, grab for all the gusto, or go for the gusto, or whatever that old expression, you know, used to be. He was saying, I decided that I was going to enjoy my life to the fullest, and I didn't withhold, you know, any pleasure. And he rejoiced. This is a theme that comes up several times in the middle of that 10th verse in chapter 2. We're on page 487. He rejoiced in what? In his labor. This is one of the great, you know, tricks and tips in life that every mother and every father needs to teach their children. How to learn to enjoy the labor itself, the job itself, the activity itself. Even when it's difficult, even when it's hard, when it's frustrating, all these things, how to learn to find satisfaction in the labor, in the work itself. You can rejoice in that, but you need to learn how to rejoice in that. Carol, do you have a comment?
Yeah, it goes back to chapter 1, verse 8. All things are full of labor.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're going to have labor, then you better figure out how to enjoy it.
Exactly that. Listen, brethren, if you're going to make a transatlantic journey, and you're not going to do it on Carnival Cruise Lines, you know, suppose you're going to do a transatlantic journey on a very small boat. It won't take long before you're going to know every inch of the boat. And outside the boat, what have you got? This vast what? Sameness and emptiness. Okay? So what do you need to learn how to rejoice in? Water. Maybe I should have used a better one. This won't work quite as well for you folks, but when Dawn and I live 6 hours north, 300 miles north of here, the weather is significantly and noticeably worse. I actually love gray. There are so many shades of gray. And the sky can be beautifully gray if you just learn to look up there and realize the infinite shading. It's like some kind of abstract painting or something, and it's changing all the time. But what do you find a whole lot of people do here in the beautiful Pacific Northwest? What are they complaining about all the time? The gray sky and rain and all the rest of that. It's really astonishingly beautiful if you develop, you know, an eye and an appreciation for it. You can learn these things. Somebody give me another one. Positive thing in the book. Scanning down through it.
Two are better than one.
Okay? So we were to extend that lesson a little bit. Learn how to get along with other people. Learn how to work with other people. The expression, no man is an island, is really not entirely true. If you want to isolate yourself, you can. You know, you can become a hermit if you want to. It's not healthy. It's not helpful. It's likely going to be a problem if you don't have a circle of friends, which is one of the major reasons I believe that churches exist in the first place, so that we have interactions with other people and help each other, even as our announcements indicate every time, you know, we begin an assembly. And what else can you find? Is it a little louder? I'm sorry, I still miss. I was talking about. Eat, drink, and be merry. Exactly that. You know, learn how to relish a meal, any meal, every meal. Carol.
The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him.
All right, the sleep of the laboring man, as opposed to, you know, the guys that are spending all their nights worrying and fretting, you know, about how to handle the money that they've got. Well, we could go on and on like this, couldn't we? The book is full of the great things that are under the sun. Some of them what we might call counterintuitive, like the labor thing, but what this wisest of all men is doing is saying, look, I'm giving you the tips and the tricks, I'm giving you the tools of the trade so that you can learn to relish life, to thrill to life under the sun. Yeah, there's a lot of repetition in it. There's a lot of evil that's in it. There's a lot of things that are frustrating, but you don't have to spend your time being frustrated. What's one of the greatest things that he extols the virtues of in his book? Married life, and how that these two are supporting each other, you know. And now then, last week, as we continue our review, what else did we find he wrote a whole book on? Song of Solomon, as it's typically called, the Song of Songs, you'll sometimes hear it referred to, is a wonderful ode to love. So I pointed out last week, there are several different views there. Well, I probably shouldn't ask. I'll just go through them because I'm not sure you'd I even touched on this in these terms. But of the Song of Solomon, there are three major approaches to it. One of them is that it's an allegory, and in fact, I'm pretty sure I did not talk about this last week. A lot of people think that this book is about the relationship between Christians and
the world.
No? Christians and Christ. That this is supposed to be about how it is that in the Ephesian letter, our relationship to the Lord is described as a marriage. And so what they think they see here is that it's not about the physical love. It's a spiritual allegory comparison of our relationship that we have with Christ or that Christ has with the church. That has always frustrated me that this view even exists, because it seems so patently silly, you know, to read the book like that. And there's just so many different things that it would be very difficult to try to, you know, interpret in that manner. So that one, you know, to me, it just seems impossible. A very popular one that I did mention last week, though, is that this is the story of a love triangle. If it's a love triangle, tell me now again, class, who are the three parties in the triangle, theoretically? Okay, a young man, a young woman, and an old lecherous king by the name of Solomon. So I pointed out last week, really seems nearly as silly as this allegory approach to think that a book named after this man, I believe written by this man, would make the man a lecherous, depraved, you know, evil dude. Why would you make yourself the villain? Well, you know, you would never do that. And if you were, as I pointed out, going to pretend to be King Solomon, or even say that you're writing like King Solomon, all of it in this scenario would still yet be demeaning, degrading to King Solomon. You'd just be dragging him through the mud. And popular as that view has been among us as Christians, again, it just seems outrageously incorrect to me. So, for my part at least, you make your own decisions here, but what was the third one that I suggested the book was about? Okay, I think it's a story of true love. It looks to me like it is what it represents itself to be. It is about a young couple who are in the first flushes of first love, and then marriage, and then a lifelong union, and they are extolling the virtues of that relationship, which repeatedly came up in the book of Ecclesiastes. You know, throughout this second book, the Song of Songs, he's just trying to say that marital love is great. What was it about? And of all the wives, he found one woman that he thought was the most beautiful, captivating, amazing, and wonderful thing that ever lived. So he spends chapters talking about her. And what did she find? Sorry, ladies, I was looking for Tom Selleck or I couldn't come up with something else. But you know, you get the point, is that the book is about these two speaking in the most florid form of poetic, you know, compliments of how much they love each other. So they describe each other at length. Now, I really felt like I shorted this book last week. I'm not going to spend a lot more time on it, but I gave the handout and all I did was just wave it at you, you know, sit you home with it, especially for those that listen on tape. I do want to spend just a couple more minutes in an outline here now. Now, I think, again, we dealt with Song of Solomon recently. I did it at very great length, and so, you know, I was just passing over it then. But my understanding of the book, I hope you'll also appreciate, is not my understanding of the book. I stole it, lock, stock, and barrel, from Kyle and Delitzsch. Okay? They're very famous commentators, very difficult commentators to read, as a matter of fact. I seldom resort to them. But somewhere in the far distant past, I was into Kyle and Delitzsch, and they were the ones back in the 1800s who suggested this particular approach. And this approach is that this is a song, but one might think of it more as a musical, an opera, or a play that was intended to be presented to the public with actors involved, so that you have a chorus of beautiful female voices. These singers are the chorus, and then you have Solomon himself, or some singer representing him, and the young Shulamite or Shunammite, depending on the translation that you have, his betrothed, and they are singing back and forth. And this play, I believe, because Kyle Delitzsch suggested it, made sense to me, you know, is presented in seven acts or seven scenes. So you just want to jot these down now, and again, for the sake of those that listen at home. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, is the harem scene. Solomon had a harem. And as a matter of fact, I meant to get this. Let me see if I can pick it out real quickly now. I knew I was going to do this. There's a statement, brethren, can you find it? It's in the Song of Solomon, which starts on page 496. But it's in one of the right-hand columns where he tells you, here it is, on page 501. Everybody, 501. Page 501, and we're in chapter 6 of the book. And in chapter 6, look at verse 8 in the right-hand column up toward the top third there. How many queens are there in chapter 6, 8? 60. How many concubines are there? 80. So, would this have been written relatively early or later in Solomon's life? Apparently early. Because again, in the historical reading that we'll be talking about in a moment, and you've already seen in Kings, we're now going to get it in Chronicles, he had a total of 1,000 women that he was married to in these two capacities as, you know, full marriage and then concubines eventually in his life. So at the time he's writing this book, he's only got 140. So just barely old, what is that, 15%? So, you know, he's got a long way to go yet. So for him, this is relatively young love, if you will. But by our standards still, and looking at the screen, that is a huge what? Harem. okay, which these Oriental kings frequently and almost without exception, you know, had. And so in this harem scene, we get the setting of the stage initially, you know, in the beginnings of the actual story. But what takes place in those 11 verses takes place in the harem. Then you have in chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 17, the verses that deal with a courtship. This is prior to their marriage. Nothing they ever do is sinful or untoward or in any way, you know, inappropriate. There's a courtship that takes place. Then in chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, there is a dream, which is a very positive thing. In chapter 3, verse 6 through chapter 5, verse 1, you have all the pomp and circumstance of a royal wedding. The wedding takes place. Then, chapter 5, verse 2 through chapter 6, verse 3, we have another dream, only this time, what kind of a dream is it? This is a bad dream. This is a nightmare dream. Now, rather than idealizing, you know, her beloved, she's locked in, cannot find him, and is abused even as she's lost in the night trying to locate him. And so this is, you know, if presented as a play, a very different kind of music. It would have a very different, you know, set of notes, and the singing, you know, would then be frightening or somehow, you know, awesome or awful. And then we come out of this into chapter 6, verse 4, through chapter 8, verse 4, and now we're well after the wedding. They love each other and have a fine and happy marriage that is going on, which comes to the conclusion of the book in chapter 8, verses 5 through 14, where they are now well advanced in years. They're coming to the end of a very long lifetime, and marriage together is how the song is being portrayed. Solomon himself writing it may not be that old, but the play that people would see the curtains part and then the chorus begins in the harem and we have scene changes and then, you know, the various songs going on is about the lifetime of wedded bliss from its very beginning to its very end. From the young woman being taken into the harem and prepared for marriage, through the courtship, through the wedding, through their mature years and then their later years, it's all about being happily married. This, at least for me, brethren, take it or leave it, is really the only sensible way to understand the book. It deals with sexual love sometimes in pretty stark and surprising terms by our standards. But that is what it's about. And we don't have to say as Christians, well, oh, no, you know, we can't be looking at anything that's actually erotic, so we've got to figuratize it away somehow, you know, turn it into a relationship between Christ and us spiritually. For me, I just don't think any of that is necessary. Solomon is a pretty frank guy about life where? Under the sun. And that's what this book is about. It's about love under the sun. He wrote 12 chapters in Ecclesiastes in which repeatedly he said, learn how to love your mate and spend a lifetime loving that mate. And then there's this whole book about the same thing. But can you have too much of a good thing? Okay. So I did get some questions about this this week, and I want to go back then into last week's reading to page 496 to pick up the thread, and then we'll complete that thought in this week's reading. We'll be looking at 1 Kings chapter 11. So 1 Kings 11, just starting with verse 1, and that'll be found on page 496 there in the left-hand column. So the first 8 verses of 1 Kings 11. But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, who seems somehow to really be a chosen or favored one. Women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. Now, with most of those, when you're reading about those people, though not necessarily the Sidonians, because of course Hiram was from that region, and Solomon had a good relationship with him, but at various times he had problems with all these nations. These nations are what kind of nations? Are they Jews? No. Are they friendly? No. Have there been wars fought? Yes. Did God forbid marrying them? Yes. And so Solomon now loved them anyway. From the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it was so, and now we finally get, you know, a very clear identifiable time stamp when Solomon was what? When he was old. So not during the writing of the Song of Solomon. Not then. Maybe if, you know, we guess correctly on Ecclesiastes, about the time he's wrapping up the book of Ecclesiastes, but maybe years after that, we can't quite tell. But in verse 4, it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. Now, always want to be careful here. Whose fault was it? Well, it's Solomon's fault two different ways. What's the first way that's named? You are not to marry these women. You are not to be marrying women who are not Jews, because what will they do? They'll turn your heart away after these other gods. So he failed completely in disobeying God's command and choosing to do it anyway. But what is not really named in the passage, what's the second failure? Yes. Was it necessary that once he had violated one of God's commands and he had married these women, that he then should go ahead still and serve their gods? Could he have committed only the one crime by marrying the forbidden women and still, other than that sin, been faithful to his God? We could have. So you see, he's failed twice, and he's failed big time. Alright, so his heart then, in the end of verse 4, was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. And what's particularly worrisome and disappointing is that we're specifically told when this happened in his life. When did it happen? At the very end. Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians. After Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem. More on that in a minute. And for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So in these first 8 verses, how bad is it? It is widespread idolatry that Solomon is introducing into Israel. And by the way, where would Solomon be introducing all this idolatry? In Jerusalem. He's not keeping any wives way up north in Galilee, you know, in Megiddo. The wives are all going to be there in Jerusalem. And so at the very center of of God's religion, where Solomon himself had built what that took him 7 years? The temple. He built the temple. And then what does he do in his older days? He allows idolatry, permits idolatry, is himself apparently involved in this idolatry, and it's all because of the power of these women, which God knew and warned about. Now, if you'll turn to page 503, which is in the reading that was designated for this week, you'll see the next verse, 9, in 1 Corinthians 11. So the very lower right-hand column there, continuing now in 1 Kings 11, verse 9, so the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods. but he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. I will tear it out of the hand of your son, now on the top of page 504. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So, this for me is one of those imponderables, and I think it is for most people too. We can glimpse, kind of some of it, but still, kind of a hard idea for us. Has Solomon sinned spectacularly? Sure he has. And whose fault is it? Well, it's his fault, okay? And what he's done here in the heart of Jerusalem is just horrifyingly evil. So who should be punished? Well, him. Is he? He's not. He's really not. He escapes the whole thing. Why? Exactly, and that brings us in, thank you, to the part that's confusing for us. For David's sake, who's been dead for how long? 40 years. For David's sake, I am not going to tear the kingdom out of your hand while you're living. So what we think, of course, automatically is, what does David care? He's been dead for 4 decades. How should it matter to him, at all? The only suggestion I might propose for you, though, is that when he says for your father David's sake, if we would think in terms not of what it meant, what it means to David, but what it would mean to God. Did God make promises to David about his son and the throne? Did God really love David, who was faithful unto death? Okay? I rather think that this is difficult for us because we think of how David would feel about it. I'm going to do it because it makes David happy. That's not, I think, what the phrase has to do with. It's more about God saying, taking the kingdom away from you, Solomon, would be like breaking a promise to David. It would be like demeaning David. It would be like an insult to David. It would be a blot on David's record. I want to leave the kingdom in your hands all the way to your death so that father and son can have the kingdom. And I'm doing it, for David's sake, but it's because of the way I feel about David and not the way David feels about Solomon or anything else. Go ahead, Carol.
With the culture back then, one of the worst things that
could
happen to a family would be to have your children and your grandchildren, your name blotted out. So, by the fact that David's name isn't blotted out in this way, it sort of correlates with what you're talking about.
We get a generation separation. David.
He also promised David forever. That's a long time, so he had to keep that promise.
Well, but it was conditional. If your sons will be righteous. It says so in a couple of places. But you're right, it still goes to that David's righteousness is so precious, and God therefore wanting to reward it. That maybe this is a poor illustration, but it's as if, in God's mind, David still lives. David, can still be besmirched, if you will. And so the punishment is going to take place a generation away. Bill?
God also loved Solomon. He picked him specially out of the line of succession to be the next king. And while he doesn't so much say it here as he does about David, he did love Solomon very much.
Solomon had done a magnificent job all the way till 38th or 39th year, somewhere in his old age, there at the end. Okay, so what do we have? Well, what we've got is that you're going to lose the kingdom, but it won't be while you're living. It'll take place immediately upon your death. I will not tear, we're at the top of page 504 now, looking at verse 13. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, whom I have chosen. Now, before we go any farther in the text itself tonight, let me have everybody's attention on the screen here. Because, remember that God Chemosh had a shrine, a temple, some sort of idolatrous worship that took place where? We were told in the early part of chapter 11, back on 496. It was east of Jerusalem on what? On the hill. Okay. This hill, and you can see the line right there, is the hill. Okay? Right down there is the street. This is the Kidron Valley in the Sea of Houses. It's hard to see. I've got several photos. There's the road. That road, snaking down through here, is the Kidron Valley. And it turns the corner right here. And these houses, all these houses that you see right here, this is the neighborhood they call what today? I've introduced you to this several times. This is called Silwan today. That is Silwan. Silwan you hear about on the news all the time because it is entirely occupied by Palestinians. And constantly, they have all kinds of uproar there. If any of the Jews, you know, wander in there, the cars get stoned, you know, you have terrible stuff that goes on. And so that hill, as a matter of fact, I have to get my bearings here. I think it's right around this corner here. But that's the Valley of Gehenna. And it's really not in this picture. It's back this way. But I walked down the Valley of Gehenna until I met a roadblock of police officers. And they told me, you know, they would ask me, what are you doing? So I'm just hiking around in Gehenna. I said, okay. But don't go any farther. Because if you do, you're going to be coming right here to Silwan. And they told me, frankly, we can't protect you down there. You're in mortal danger down there. You're in lethal danger down there. Do not go down there. I was okay. So I didn't. But this is Silwan. It is one of the sorest places in all of the Jerusalem area. It is also, notice this flat part right here, and these trees, we'll talk about more of them in a minute, and that wall you see right there, that is also the top of a nice little flat hill that is called the Mount of, and don't say Olives. Got you good, didn't I? Because it is the southernmost and tailing off down into the valley end of the Mount of Olives. It is. But that's really not what the Jews thought of it as in ancient history or even to this day. It is called, this section, the Mount of Offense. And who did the offending? Solomon. With what God? Chemosh, because of one of his foreign wives who was from, you remember? Moab, that's a Moabite god. And he set up an idolatrous temple or shrine of some sort, apparently right on that hill. In the uninspired history of the Jews, they said, that's where he put it. It is in the inspired history, only on a hill east of Jerusalem. But the uninspired history, the oral history unwritten of the Jews, is that it was on that end right there. So now, remember again, I've introduced you to this wall and those trees right there on the Mount of Offense. That's the southern end as you look to the east and somewhat to the south. Here's more of it. So you were looking up to those trees and this wall. See how it tails off? Now you can see almost all of Silwan and almost all of the hill. And you can make out that there's a nice big flat area up here. And you can see right there is the end of it, the hill, and it's going to start rising again off to the left.
So again, remember now, you can see a lot more of this wall. You see this big, flat, park-like area right here. This is the mount of offense. And you can see this road now right here. This photograph is taken from the area that to this day is called the City of David. This is where David's palace was. And if David's living right there, and he's got a really favored wife, and she's a Moabitess, and she wants to have an idolatrous location for her god, where did everybody, Jews included, want to put the shrines to their gods? On a high place, on a hill, a high place. That's just the best one around. Okay? It is a preeminent location. It has a fabulous view. 360 degrees from there. It was just the prime choicest real estate you could imagine at the time, and it was immediately adjacent to the palace area of David and his son. Now, as you look at this photograph, I realize the aerial now has kind of, you know, disoriented everybody, but remember what I was talking about, the Kidron Valley. This is the Kidron Valley, right through here, just like that. It goes around like that. And then the valley of the Gehenna comes in from here and hits it right there. And now you see the 35-acre Temple Mount. This golden dome of rock, as Islam calls it, as the Muslims call it, you know, their shrine today, that's the immediate location where Solomon's temple was first built and where it stood. You can clearly see, it's a wonderful picture, the external wall of what is called the Old City. So you can see the north wall of the city. The west wall is a little bit out of sight right here. But you can also follow the line right through here, and especially right through there, that is the south wall of the city. That is Old Jerusalem from antiquity. And here is Silwan, and now you can see all of it. And here are those trees we were looking at, with the wall right there. And now you can see right there is where we start back uphill again. And when people today say, the Mount of Olives, well, you know, we just tend to include this hill, but there's a tiny, shallowest little bit of saddle there. It's the Mount of Offense is a separate hill. And then you get the Mount of Olives proper. What is all this sea of gray right here? Or khaki, tan. Graves. They're tombs. Jewish tombs on that end of the Mount of Olives proper. So, when you're on the Temple Mount, taking all your photographs of the Mount of Olives, when you think about Jesus, you know, going down, the Garden of Gethsemane is believed to be right there. You know, this is where, you know, all the events of Jesus' life are taking place there on that last night. And when he goes up on the Mount of Olives, in these locations, I've been in that parking lot right there, you have this wonderful view that is just, you know, 100 feet or so above the level of the Temple Mount. So you look down on it, you can see everything. All right, so now I'm introducing the Mount of Olives. And in this photograph, another aerial photograph, you've got, you know, the lay of the land again, and this time we've come well to the north and to the west. This again is the outside, you know, wall of the city, and then the Kidron Valley is running down through here, and now there's all the trees that are the park on the Mount of Offense, where the Chemosh idol was, and now you can see how it rises up right through here, the first of the three towers. It is the Mount of Olives proper with all these graves right here and where the main road goes by and all the tourists hang out, you know, and take their pictures and all that right there. I believe I got two more photographs. Okay, two more. It's a little bit clearer, but now the photographer has turned a little bit more to the north. Can you see in this photograph the Mount of Offense? No. Just that tiny little bit of trees is all there is. The shadow is a little bit of a saddle. Here's all those graves. And the first of the three towers that so prominently mark the ridgeline to the east of the Temple Mount and the old city walls that now you can see even more clearly. So, Mount of Olives proper. I'm going to get you again. I know this is detailed, but if this is the Mount of Offense, the Mount of Olives is this part right here. What's this part. There's a third tower. One, two, three. The third tower is not on the Mount of Olives. What is it on?
Scopus. Mount Scopus.
Now, this is not a hill that's directly mentioned in Scripture, but in 70 A.D., when the temple finally falls, actually in 66, when Vespasian comes and then Titus after him, the Romans are going to set up shop here on Scopus because that's the highest point to look down on Jerusalem. So all the planning for the 3.5-year siege, the eventual fall and burning of the temple and the end of, you know, the old law, you know, the Romans are going to do up here on Scopus. It's just a little bit taller than the actual Mount of Olives itself, which sort of has two peaks too.
So I'm going to zoom in one more time on this same photograph into that area right there. Okay, and then I won't belabor this anymore, but since both the Old and New Testaments give us so much geographical information, I really think it's important we try to grasp it as best we can.
It really does help you put your feet into their sandals, you know, and get back into things. But when you zoom in right here, this is the one of the main tourist entrances, the Jaffa Gate, spelled J-A-F-F-A, that you'll enter Jerusalem and go to explore the old city. Here is the wall for the Temple Mount itself, right through there, with, you know, the Golden Dome on it. And now, more clearly, you can only see the saddle that would then lead up to the Mount of Offense on the south. You can clearly see the two peaks with each a tower that is the Mount of Olives proper. And then there's just the tiniest little bit of a saddle right here. This angle doesn't look like it. The Scopus is actually a little bit higher, and that's Hebrew University's tower. The Hebrew University there is that third tower. This is where Solomon spent what? His whole life. Was Solomon a big man of war? Well, he had problems at the end because of his unfaithfulness. You read about it. God raised up adversaries against him. But, you know, he was born here. He was born in this town. He was raised in the court. David took care of the enemies. Solomon was a man of peace and not blood. So he was allowed to build that temple there. And so he lived out all of his days there. It is just the most awful tragedy. All of his brethren is building. And this one last question, which I was asked a couple of times this week. Did Solomon go to heaven? All I can say to you is, the Scripture offers no hope. The Scripture does not give even an inkling of any repentance, of any forgiveness, of any relenting of God's anger on Solomon. The grand and huge point of tonight, brethren, is that the wisest of the wise still can choose to not take their own advice. Nobody will ever be free of free will. Nobody, if Solomon is any witness, will ever be entirely free of either temptation or foolishness. Even if you wrote the book on wisdom, you could still play the part of the fool. And it's just such a tragedy. He got through the vast majority of his life. Only when he's described as old, he decides to take some of the most beautiful property in all of Israel. This would be the high rent district of the day. And what did he do on the top? He built an idolatrous shrine. How can it be?
Well, brethren, it just breaks my heart. I really wish we could offer some hope, but there is none anywhere in Scripture for Saul.
If you know, why did the Muslims choose to build their house on the side of the temple?
Say again, why did they build their houses?
Why did they build their worship house on the side of the temple?
On the side?
There's a couple of reasons, but
This is the site where Abraham was asked to sacrifice Isaac. And that's the first time you hear about it. And so this had been chosen by God, you know, very early on as his location or his purposes or his reasons. But, you know, we have a number of incidents in religious history that take place that are you know, important that deal with Mount Moriah. So, but the first one there goes all the way back to 1900 BC and Solomon. And Jerry?
I understand, Bill. He's asking why is the dome built on the site of Solomon?
Oh, why did the Muslims build it there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, first, you know, they are duty bound to try to desecrate, defile, and destroy anything that's related to what religion? See, the Jews. So they're mortal enemies. And so that's one of the first things everybody would do, is that you destroy the house of the God, you know, that you hate and of the people that you've defeated, and then you build your own. Okay? And so first there's that. But Muslims also have a tradition, and certainly, you know, in event it's just a myth, but supposedly this is where Muhammad took his night ride. Are you guys familiar with the night ride of Muhammad? Muhammad claimed to have been taken up into heaven also, rode a horse, and went up into heaven. And he claimed that took place, you know, here off of that rock. Immediately underneath this, though none of us as non-Muslims are allowed to go in there anymore. It used to be able to go inside there and you could actually see it. There's a magnificent, huge rock with a cave underneath it that this was built above. So that when you go in, there's a subterranean part underneath, but much of what's inside there, you can find photos all over the internet, but if you go in there, you know, you didn't look at the photos, you can see there's just a really huge bedrock, massive rock there. And so it was the site, apparently, of Abraham's attempted sacrifice. It is a mythological, you know, view of Islam that Muhammad went up to heaven there. And so clearly God had significance there, and the Muslims wanted to destroy the Jewish significance. To this day, brethren, it's really a tragedy, but in fact, I'm not sure if I can show you in this picture, but it would be just about right, well, that's it right there. See this site right here? Very tiny little gray spot right there, okay? And then look at this site right here, which is the southeast corner of the Temple Mount. You see those two big pavement areas right there? The Waqf, W-A-Q-F, is the Muslim authority in charge of the Temple Mount. And they are conducting illegal, unobserved digs underneath that area. And it's been massively changed, and they've created an entire subterranean underground meeting hall that's huge. There's a big flight of stairs that goes down there now. And here in one of the most archaeologically significant places on Earth, they are conducting a dig that has nothing to do with archaeology except that they are consciously and purposely destroying anything they find that looks like it might indicate that Jews were ever here. And so in their mythology, the Jews never were here. They don't deserve any of it. And they often try to actually say they weren't even here, and they're destroying artifacts that they find. The dirt that they've excavated so illegally is then being gathered by a group of people who are sifting it and going through the pulverized pieces on that site right there. So they're trying sort of to reconstruct, you know, what's going on there, but it's a very destructive dig that's going on at this point. And so to this day, they're carrying on the same work that explains why the Muslims would build, you know, a temple there. Okay, so, you know, a couple more minutes left. And last week, you know, we had a lot of questions. Bill had a really good one after class that you didn't hear, but I showed you quite a number of the temple structures, and that's all the duplicated material that we studied last week, and you're reading about it again this week. This is one of my very favorite and more highly detailed artist illustrations of the temple that Solomon built. You have the large labor here. The sea is 7.5 feet tall, 15 feet in diameter. It holds, in our terms, not baths, but gallons. It held 12,000 gallons of water, which the priests washed themselves in. Very bloody sacrifices are offering, all the butchering going on, and then all the ash and whatnot that goes on with the burning. And so, you know, they were washing there. And then, these are called, you know, the water stands, remember from last week, T 10 bronze wheel stands and basins held water for rinsing off what was used for the offering. So before the meat was offered on the altar itself, they, you know, get all the butchery and cut it all up into pieces, whatever they were going to do, and then they would wash it in these five layers on this side and five on the other side. What Bill brought up was about these two pillars. They're rather mysterious. There's not a lot said about them. And so I showed you pictures where they were only half pillars because they were up against the wall. And Bill did me a favor, and now you, by pointing out that, well, if there's a circumference given for them, then they must have been detached and stand alone. But in the reading, if you read especially the commentary, you would have also noticed there are two very dramatically different figures that are given for how tall those columns were. What is 40 cubits in feet? 60 feet. What's 18 cubits? 27 feet. What's the difference between 27 and 60? A lot. Okay? So in the reading this week, we are told that these pillars are 60 feet tall. In the reading last week, we were told they're 27. I have no doubt now that Bill is right, and they were detached. They were somehow standalone. Whether or not they supported a structure above, we don't know. It's hard to tell. Maybe not. But I think there's a simple solution to this, too. What do you have on the base here in this drawing? You got a platform that the pillar stands on. Okay? Now, what do you notice about this section as opposed to this section? It's really very different. And we're told that there's a very different top on this thing, very ornate, as opposed to the pillar itself. So, what may be the case is as simple as the 27-foot figure has to do with this distance right here, or maybe from here to there. And then the total 60 would be as simple as just having a base that was much taller. And then you put the, you know, column on top of it. And so once again, there's absolutely no contradiction. They are two wildly different figures. It does not mean that an error took place by any means. I know I've gone a minute over, but let me just zoom in one more time. Because I've shown you so many of these pictures, and I really want you to see as many as possible. We have these descriptions. We're not entirely sure what it looked like, of course. But the gold-covered and very exquisitely ornate interior of the temple is particularly well illustrated here. And then you have the wall-to-wall, wingtip-touching seraphim or cherubim?
Cherubim.
Okay. So these are portrayed as four-footed animals facing with their wings as if they were about to take flight. However, might just as well have been an individual standing with wings, you know, like this. We just don't know. It took Hiram from up north, as well as other skilled artisans, to create it. But I particularly like this one because it shows the storage rooms here in a cutaway, and then it describes, and I'll read this for you, a structure was built around the walls of the temple itself containing three levels. The lower chamber was 7.5 feet wide, the middle chamber was 9 feet wide, and the upper chamber was 10.5 feet wide. And we're specifically told that he used these ledges so that the temple itself did not have, you know, any pounding or anything done on it, no inserts made to support it. It was built in such a manner that it provided these shelves so that increasingly larger storage rooms might be built. Now, one more thing, and I'll let you go. If you look carefully at these doors, today, what's the term we use for this kind of a door? We call that what? It's called a bifold door. You go to buy a house, you know, and you ask, are they bypass or bifold doors on the closet? They were bifold doors that are described as such on both sides, and again, all covered with gold. And of course, there's also a curtain that was further involved. But don't you think? Just an excellent cutaway and view of the temple. Okay, over time, any comment or question?